From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next Producers Picks, highlights of a conversation heard on a previous episode. On today's show,
being as starkly segregated as we are, and it's always been that way here, especially over the past century, that, you know, we have systemic segregation, the effects of which still linger, and some of the practices still linger.
Founder of Reconnector, Seamus Gallivan. And we close with,
our story transcends individual locations. There's all sorts of points of connection. The people who are involved in telling these stories were multifaceted. So there's different parts of their lives that touch upon different museums or historical sites or agencies.
Buffalo's first female historian, Lindsay Lauren Visser. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. First, we revisit my conversation with Seamus Gallivan. We speak on his latest endeavor, Reconnector, a social connection space that aims to bring people together in person and online by illuminating the ties that bind us. You know, since I've known you, you've always had your hand in something, or at least tried to bring awareness to events or issues in the region.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Thomas. It's an honor to be on this show. I really want to say first that how much I love and appreciate this show, What's Next. I know I've told you this off the air, but I think everyone should really take a moment to appreciate it. It's essential listening. It has been since May 14th when it was started. After this, I told you I hold calls from 10 to 11 a.m. to tune into this. And because of that, because of a care about issues in our community and wanting to be connected, wanting to know what's happening in our city and area. And I think I've just always been fascinated with social connection since I was a kid. You know, I'm a fourth generation Buffalonian. I was raised in Kenmore because of no residency requirement. I'm a son of a firefighter, Buffalo firefighter, but born here, raised nearby. And really, I think maybe when I was a kid, we always seemed to have a connection to anything of interest. We were, you know, in Buffalo, there's at maximum 2 degrees of separation.
Right.
You know, no six. In Buffalo, it's two, you know. And for me, it seemed like one. And it seemed like we always knew someone or something that was relevant. And that really, it hit home for me at a formative age. When I was eight, my great uncle, Monsignor David Herlihy, was murdered by two teenagers in his rectory.
Wow.
That was 1987, and it was at St. Matthew's in Wyoming in Ferry, in East Ferry. And that really, you know, I remember vividly, we were close, I remember vividly receiving the news from my mother and in tears, and remember being in the courtroom and really staring at those two young men, seeking some kind of understanding.
Uh-huh.
And just not getting it. And, you know, it's so hard to make sense of something like that. And when you can't make sense of something, you know, a tragedy, something so heavy, you can turn away and just be fearful or be angry and want it to go away.
You took a different route.
Yeah, try to understand, you know, seek the root cause. And ever since then, I feel it had a profound impact on me, wanting to understand the root cause of issues. What causes the problems that we have, and so I've always sought to understand, and in a city like ours, you know, that led me to seek out the root causes of segregation and poverty, and you know, and I still seek a connection with those two men. I keep up on them. I know where they are. I every once in a while I hear some news. I hear that one is really on a path to rehabilitation and studying theology, and I look forward to learning more about that. And you know, still trying to make sense of that while overall, you know, growing up and becoming more involved in the community as a whole, seeing that we really have a lack of understanding of each other and a real disconnect in our community.
Well, how does that make you feel to you know, keep up on those guys who just committed a obviously heinous crime against a member of your family, but to see like one of them seemingly getting his life together? I mean, he's obviously still locked up, but seemingly on a good path.
Yeah, you know, that was really interesting news. I was just told recently, and it's, you know, it's encouraging, and it you know, it gives hope.
Right.
And you know, what do we have without hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
So beyond hope, you know, is action. And they're, you know, they killed a second priest, Father David Bissonnette, and that's sort of the roots of Bissonnette House, what became with Sister Karen, the Peace Prince movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they're going to still be away, be in prison for another 15 years or so. So, you know, what their future is a little certain for now. Mm-hmm. Though, you know, I hope that we're all still here in 15 years and there will be an opportunity for them to, you know, they'll be up for parole. And I wrote a victim impact statement at 8 or 9 years old. Wow. And so maybe I'll be called upon to be mm-hmm. part of that process. And if I'm fortunate to still be here, I'll be part of it.
Let's talk this revelation you had a couple months ago. Talk to me about the revelation and what that revelation has led to.
Yeah. You were there at Bayville back in December. It was.
I was.
And I know you were aware. Revelation is a big word right now, especially if we're talking theology.
Right.
So, you know, I wanted to start something new. You know, funny side story of that was I didn't have the web domain. I was still bidding on the web domain, so I didn't want to say what the name was. I didn't want to give away the letter. Like, how am I going to promote this event without the name Reconnector?
Yes.
And
yes.
So, you know, so I used that sort of revelation term, and of course that sent people stirring about what it was.
It certainly did.
Maybe some of them still are. So it really just comes down to social connection. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have that formative experience, but I've really sort of practiced that fascination with social connection. I put it through my work, and I can tell as a connector that it's something that I really care deeply about and want to put all my energy into. So with Reconnector, it was really rooted in the sort of lack of social connection, right? Mm-hmm. Some of these issues that we have in Buffalo are really, you know, we have, and they're not unique to Buffalo. They're really prominent in Buffalo. So in being as starkly segregated as we are, and it's always been that way here, especially over the past century, that, you know, we have systemic segregation, the effects of which still linger, and some of the practices still linger. And in my work as a storyteller, as an event planner, promoter, and as a community organizer, I still sort of stay rooted in that care for social connection. And I found that it's really powerful. It's really necessary. And we have our Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, has declared an epidemic of loneliness and social isolation.
Wow.
So we have really new issues, you know, social media and the continued effects of suburban sprawl that are isolating people. And we have all these mental health issues now, right, that are really connected to us being disconnected, to people being isolated. And of course, you know, the roots of this show in a response to May 14th.
Right.
You know, that person who perpetrated that terrorism was isolated and disconnected. And there's a sort of an ignorance that comes with that we can address through education, through social connection, through getting together in person. And so my experience is a lot in sharing people's stories and bringing people together. And so Reconnector is essentially that. It's a social enterprise providing social connection through events and media. So I want to bring people together in person. Mm-hmm. Also using, you know, a website, an email newsletter, conversations like this.
Yes. So
over podcasts to really bring light to people, places, causes, and ultimately inspire action. And so, yes, that event at Bayville, with revealing the Reconnector, we sort of tested out a few things of sort of, you know, from an entertainment sense, from an education sense, and just from a social connection sense of bringing people together.
So, and talk a little bit more about the program.
Sure.
You had music, you had kind of like a sit down. And it's funny, you know, you were talking about, you know, being able to tell other people's stories, but now you're sitting here kind of telling your own story. is that kind of strange in a way?
I don't know. I have most of the privileges in this world, you know.
Right.
I'm comfortable being in the center of attention. I always have been, and actually, a lot of my work is figuring out how to get out of the center of attention while still being relevant and still helping. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little too comfortable talking about myself, Thomas. But I would rather, you know, put the spotlight on others, especially those who don't get as much of an opportunity as I do,
right,
to tell my story, you know?
Yeah. So a little bit more about the event, the revelation in December.
Yes. So we had that open social time at the beginning. That's act one.
Yes.
Act two is the Buffalo down. And I sort of jokingly call it a hoedown with a lowdown on Buffalo, but the hoedown suggests that it's country music, but it's just music. It's, you know, sort of just let go of the genres. And there's music, there's conversations, there are other performances. And so that particular night at Babeville, you know, I had my sister India Walton as a co-host, and she'll be a part of this next Buffalo Down as well. And we talk about social connection and our story, and then we brought up other people to talk about the sort of the root inspiration of specifically of Reconnector, and that's the struggle to put the park back in Humboldt Parkway. And also we brought some youth up. You know, we had what I call youth telling.
That's right.
You know, just have the youth tell the truth, and that's as they do. And really including youth and not just as a sort of a token thing with a kids' corner, just having, you know, youth really be able to express themselves. And I really want this whole thing to be inclusive, that everyone can see themselves in it and be part of it and have that spotlight too. I just want to share people's stories and bring people together. And that can be done in many ways.
Let's talk about a little bit more about bringing people together. And, you know, like pre-COVID, there seemed to be like a lack of synergy between organizations, like progressive organizations in the area. You know, we're stronger together than we are, you know, on an island trying to figure things out. There's a lot of more resource sharing. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a complicated question, I think, a subject that, yeah, I mean, during those early months of COVID, there was a lot of solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
There was a deeper understanding of the how essential social connection is, how we are interdependent. And that, you know, in all that tragedy, the death and destruction, was a lot of beauty and beloved community. And of, I think once we're able to sort of get back to normal, as they say, the new normal is in many ways the old normal, that maybe we go back to our old ways and our old corners and our silos. And that's the memory of that. The experience is imprinted in all of us. You know, we will all take lessons and have deep, you know, experiences with COVID that have changed us. That said, I think it's kind of easy to go back to the old ways once things are sort of normalcy is restored. And I think we're willing to talk about things more.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're still, by and large, a society that is really rooted in the individual. And so a lot of people just kind of went back to their self-interests. And even in the nonprofit world, went back to just making sure that they got their grants and paid their staff. And there are remnants of that beloved time of collaboration out of necessity, out of desperation. And so, yes, maybe we're better off. I still think that we're pretty siloed still. And we sort of run against the collective interest in pursuing our individuals.
How do we continue to break down those barriers?
You know, that's why I'm just throwing myself into Reconnector in this way, is having a community events calendar on the website when it launches, and it's taking some time to get that together. And really it's just centering people in all these stories, and instead of a story necessarily about an organization or a company, it's really just get to the root of the personal story.
Yeah.
That
people focused,
that inspired the creation of the organization.
Yes.
And if we still, the part that's individual to me is shared experience, where if we can just tell someone's individual story, we can see ourselves in it, or someone we know, and find a way to work together. And I don't know. I don't know that I can, you know, I'm not going to solve these problems myself, but I'm going to throw myself into them and make Reconnector my best effort to sort of, you know, break down those barriers, break down those silos.
A little more about Buffalo Down Act 3. We forgot to mention music.
Yes, yes. So this sort of signature event for Reconnector, the Buffalo Down, you know, we have that open social time in Act 1. We have that sit-down sort of talk show with a house band in Act 2, having conversations. And music is such a core thing to me. I think it's one of the best ways to bring people together. It's a sort of a universal language. You know, you can listen to music in other languages and feel connected to to it, feel something, right? Be inspired. And And so it's always been a central thing in my life. And I've done a lot of work in the music business, in our local music community. And that's a real strength of my personal network. So I always like to include music in anything that I'm doing. And so, yeah, we have that Act Three that is actually rooted in a music show that almost aired on WBFO 15 years ago when there was the On the Border program of local music and local mm-hmm. programming. That I was, right when I moved back, I was 2 weeks away from launching this show. And it was a musical road trip, songs about places and conversations with artists about places and traveling. And so I sort of playfully call it gallivanting, just sort of wandering about in search of something. And so it's a musical road trip, and I'm bringing this to life through this house band, through an incredible band of Buffalo musicians who have come together just for this.
Seamus, off air, we are talking about the term comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. That's a term you really take to heart.
It's an interesting term, isn't it? That the root of it is actually in satire over about newspapers.
Well, we don't do that here.
I've heard a lot of artists take it to heart. A lot of activists take it to heart, and to me, it just to comfort the afflicted, to afflict the comfortable. You know, I have almost all of the privileges that are available to a person in our society. You know, short of wealth, and I've had access to that. So I've led a pretty comfortable life, and I've needed to be shaken to pay attention to the uncomfortable. And like we said, that happened at a formative age when tragedy struck my family. Though, you know, we were afflicted. And, you know, I would never wish that on anyone. But to simply afflict the comfortable, I just think that, you know, we just have to talk about things that matter. We have to share people's stories. And sometimes they're uncomfortable.
Yes.
And we have the privilege, many of us, of just looking the other way and putting them away, whether they're looking the other way or putting something away, whether it's a person in prison or whether it's just a, you know, turning off the TV or our phones and pretending, just putting off an issue that is maybe urgent to someone else. So I think true social connection is that understanding of interdependence, that if someone is uncomfortable in our community, that if we ignore it, it's at their danger, and that it may also lead to the danger of many others, including ourselves. And so I choose to be afflicted. I choose to care, and I choose to seek to understand.
So how do you, for the comfortable, how do you meet them where they're at and say, hey, there's this issue going on in your backyard? How do you get them to, I wouldn't say like get on board, but have an understanding of a certain issue?
It's a great question. You know, I descend from radical preachers on both sides of my family, so I've been guilty of preaching. It's just in me, right? Preaching doesn't always work, right?
Like, yes, right.
To truly meet someone where they're at, I think, is to just relate and sort of appeal to their senses about, you know, what do you care about and how does it connect with what's affecting someone else? And that's why I believe in the power of the personal story and doing the best that I can as a storyteller to relate it to the collective and to relate it to each other individual and understand how it affects our community as a whole. And so hopefully just create that sense of urgency through just a collective understanding. And that's hard, you know, that's why we have a lot of problems, because we're not that good at it, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we struggle with it. We are disconnected in so many ways because we have so many structural ways that we choose to disconnect from, you know, from segregation and suburban sprawl and simply now our ability, you know, so ability to just lock down in our own lives and ignore the realities outside our door. And sometimes they come to us forcefully. And so just really encouraging people to care. And honestly, that's why I go back to music, man. Like, music brings people together like nothing else. Like, it really
does.
Allows people to open up. And how many struggles do we know about through song? And how many communities do we know about through song? You know, how many people came to care about the civil rights movement through Bob Dylan blowing in the wind? How many people cared about what's happening in Jamaica through Bob Marley, right? Mm-hmm. Like just, you know, civil rights struggles around the world. And so, you know, music is central that we can open, we can gather through it. We can open up and feel good about being together and about our place, our presence in time, that we're here, which is a miracle in itself. Mm-hmm. And then just to appreciate that, that we do have these comforts, and at the same time, consider the discomfort of others.
What gets you out of bed in the morning? And I ask that because I'm a reader of Christopher Hitchens, and he always said, hate gets me up in the morning and gets me to work. I feel like I used to have that philosophy, but not anymore. So I'm always interested in what gets people out of bed and going.
I guess my best answer is really, it's a recurring theme here, but it is really what Reconnector is all about, and that's social connection. I'm in love with this community, with community as a whole. I love to go and find it. And so to get out of bed and go and find it, and how can I connect with people? How can I bring people together? And just, you know, every day is a gift and an opportunity to do that. And so, you know, we got to take some time to ourselves when we get up in the morning, maybe. And,
and
breathe a little bit. And and then
smell the coffee.
Yeah. And then, you know, when we turn on and tune in, I'm always looking for, you know, how can we come together to solve problems?
And it's, I can go to a coffee shop on the West Side and see you. I can go to a art gallery in North Buffalo and see you. I can run into you at an outdoor concert, in the old First Ward and see you. I mean, you're everywhere.
at the risk of betraying humility, there was an article in the Buffalo News in 2012. At the opening of Larkin Square, I helped open Larkin Square. And Colin Dabkowski, the writer, referred to me because he didn't know a title. You opened by saying, you don't know my title. He referred to me as, what was it, an omnipresent culture maven?
Yeah.
I said, just put it on my tombstone, man. Just that's it. I've achieved. That's peak. That's my title. That's it. Ultimately, I love this community. There's so much in it. There's an abundance of beauty in our community. And so I'm always finding it and trying to find more ways to bring more people into it, to appreciate it and make it matter, you know, make it meaningful to those who lack the access to it.
And I wanted to ask you, one, where do you see Reconnector in the next few years? And then where would you like to see Buffalo and the rest of New York in 5 years?
Well, the root inspiration of Reconnector is the struggle to put the park back in Humboldt Parkway. And I had gotten involved through Slow Roll and advocating for Parkway Revival. I was invited to the table at the Restorative our community coalition, which at the time, back in 2016, was rarely making headlines. Few people were taking them seriously. And now, of course, there's $1 billion on the table.
Yes.
And so this idea for Reconnector was a how can I put my best skills into my community's greatest need? And I identified that issue. It's the heart of our city. It's an open wound in the heart of our city. The heart and lungs, as Frederick Law Olmsted called the connected park system, the lungs of our city. And so the original vision was a free and inclusive, sprawling summertime festival in and between Delaware and MLK parks. And of course, the parks are meant for passive recreations. We get into the blocks and the neighborhoods, the streets in between, and find ways to bring people together in all kinds of ways. I like to say from art to zoo, you know, like for Albright Knox, Birchfield Penny, Buffalo Zoo, Science Museum. Like there's so many great institutions in these spaces as well. And so I would love to see Reconnector, and that's that root inspiration for it is to have a sprawling festival where everyone is welcome and everyone can express themselves and find community. And I'm starting it through this website and weekly email, reconnector.org. Reconnector with an ER, by the way. to just start building that, and so that we can get those people on board and involved, and so they see themselves in it, and build to that. And so in a few years, I would love for that to be something where, like, what are you doing on a summertime Sunday? The default thing is I'm going to the Reconnector.
Mm-hmm. Buffalo, where do you want to see Buffalo in 5 years?
Man. Well, I would love to see a fully restored Humboldt Parkway.
Yes.
And I just, you know, Reconnectors and Ideas time has come. I don't know that we could have changed the conversation about that. It's a lot of forces who want the status quo. Mm-hmm. And that is the free movement of motor vehicles, not interrupting people's commute times. So in 5 years, I would love for people to have maybe a few minutes longer commute, and we would have restore the heart of our city and have a parkway that connects Delaware and MLK Parks like it was originally designed. And so change the status quo. That would change the status quo in Buffalo. And that's what I would love to see in 5 years in Buffalo, is to change the status quo, because we know it's not working. We have pockets of resurgence, mm-hmm. But the Renaissance will not be compartmentalized. We have to bring everyone into it, and we have to have everyone see themselves in the idea of a Renaissance and have a place in it, and reduce child poverty and reduce segregation. And those are big things, man, but in 5 years, if we commit to it on the daily, we can make progress.
That was Seamus Gallivan. And we close out with another conversation I had with Buffalo's first female historian, Lindsay Lauren Visser. We discuss her appointment and some notable milestones, including the 200th anniversary of the Erie Canal in 2025. Can you give us a little bit of a background of Chikatilly Associates? What goes on over there?
Yeah, sure. So again, my name is Rashawn Smalls, and I am blessed to serve as the Community Engagement Program Manager for Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities, which I'll have an opportunity to talk about a little bit later. But that is a project of Chikatilly Associate, or short CAI for short, CAI Global. And CAI is a public health organization, not-for-profit, which has been around for probably about 45 years or so. I believe it was 1979. And we're a capacity-building organization. And so essentially, our mission is to use the transformative power of education and research to create a more aware, a more healthy, a more compassionate, a more equitable world. So the work that we do fits within through that social lens.
And so then your role in the organization is a broad approach to eliminating cigarette use.
Yeah, and so that is certainly one way of describing it. So the work that we do, I want to just simply start by saying that Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities is a statewide project. It is part of New York State's chronic disease prevention agenda. And so Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities, there is this focus on supporting New York State's smoke-free norms. There is an individual like myself in just about every county throughout the state. I and my coworker Amanda, who isn't here today, we both serve as program managers, and we work across both Erie and Niagara County. She does Reality Check, which is the youth component to the work that we do, and her focus is on developing youth leaders to use their voice to message against how tobacco industry is targeting our community. And my role on the other end is to complement that right there through community engagement. And the focus is on, again, supporting New York State smoke-free norms through a number of different approaches or initiatives.
So before we get into initiatives, mm-hmm. what are tobacco-free norms?
And so when you think about tobacco-free norms, let me give it some, try to give you what tobacco-free norms isn't, or an example of what a norm is, for instance, mm-hmm. right? So let's think about stop signs, right? You know, everyone can relate to stop signs. Some of us like them, some of us hate them,
yeah.
You know, especially when you got to get to where you got to go to, right? So stop signs are there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Stop signs stop people from, it creates order, right? It creates it's a rule that helps save lives in many instances, right? Because if we didn't have stop signs, we'd all be running through and moving at our own pace, at our own tune, and we'd end up crashing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are laws, you know, even texting while driving, right? That right there is distracting, and it could cause harm because you may not see the car that's going in the opposite direction, or you may swerve and hit another car. So those are rules or policies, right? Norms that have been ingrained in our way of life. So when you think about smoke-free norms, the goal here is to protect and save lives by reducing exposure to secondhand smoke, right? Because if, for instance, I live in a multi-unit housing complex, right? And 70% of the occupants smoke in this housing complex. And I, among the 30%, don't smoke,
mm-hmm.
right? But every day I'm going to work and my clothes smell like tobacco.
Right.
My five-year-old infant is inhaling secondhand smoke from my neighbor. Right. So when we talk about the creating or working to establish smoke-free norms, is it about if I live in this housing complex, do I have a right to breathe clean air? And how do we establish that right there? You know, and one of the ways that we've worked on it, and we'll talk about it later, is by working with multi-unit housing complexes, property owners and property managers to adopt and implement smoke-free policies, which in effect restrict smoking and reduce secondhand smoke. And, you know, and that's, I guess in some ways people don't like it, but the reality is what it does is it's a policy, a rule, but eventually it becomes a way of life, like stop signs, like texting mm-hmm. while not texting while driving or not drinking while driving and some of the other smart public health policies which save lives.
So working with these property owners to get that policy in, you know, has there been pushback from policy owners? I'm sure there's pushback from people yeah. living in those units who smoke,
mm-hmm.
but from a property manager's perspective, have they been like fully on board?
Yeah, well, that's the straight cut answer is no, right? Because with any type of implementation of policy comes with its challenges, right?
Yes.
And in COVID sort of exacerbated many issues, right? And one of the issues are many landlords struggled to get their money simply from tenants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, I'm telling you can't smoke in the building, why the hell I want to live here?
Yeah.
You know
right.
what I mean? I should be able to do what I want to do in my apartment. And, you know, and so that's one challenge that landlords face. And that's why sometimes our work has fallen on deaf ears, because landlords are saying, I simply want to, you know, just collect my rent. But on
yeah.
the other hand, you know, there are collateral consequences to smoking, which has sat or resonated well. You know, it reduces the amount of work that I have to do to repair the apartment, right? In terms of the coloration of the walls, in terms of the smoke in the ventilation system, in terms of, you know, potential fire issues which are caused by smoking. And so those things are appealing to property owners and property managers, and just the public health issue as we spoke to earlier. And so those things are attractive, and as we've done this work, it seems that we're trending toward smoke-free multi-unit housing policies across the board. HUD was one of the first to, you know, as a governmental agency, to adopt a smoke-free policy in all HUD buildings. So this is it's a real issue. I think we recognize that secondhand smoke, as the U.S. Surgeon General has said, there's no safe level of exposure to it. If you can smell it, you inhale it. And if you are inhaling it, it can exacerbate a number of health-related issues that you already have, or create some.
So moving from tobacco-free norms, talk a little bit about what tobacco-free Erie and Niagara does. I mean, you did a little bit,
get
more into that, please.
Yeah, so our work is very, very comprehensive. And when I say very, very, it is very, very comprehensive. We've talked about multi-unit housing work, right? Engaging mm-hmm. on that level. What we haven't talked about is tobacco-free outdoors, for instance. That would be another initiative that we have. And as I spoke earlier about the Surgeon General's report, there is no safe level of exposure to secondhand smoke. So when you're at the playground, when you're at the park, when you're at the beach, when you're in these outdoor spaces, mm-hmm. right? If you're being exposed to secondhand smoke, it can cause harm and will cause harm with repeated exposure. And so our work involves working with elected officials, working with community members to create this sort of education around protecting these spaces, these outdoor spaces, working with employers as well to protect these outdoor spaces. Because if I'm at a space 8, 9, 16 hours a day, right, which we work and I'm going, you know, and people are allowed to smoke, then that's impacting my health. So we work across not just housing, but also tobacco-free outdoors work sites. And we also have a focus on retail, right? We look at how can we prevent tobacco industry from using marketing to attract, you know, to attract new users, to attract, to continue to perpetuate and sell tobacco products. So we look at a number of different approaches in terms of retail and how the tobacco industry is marketing its product as well.
And so your agenda also includes, you know, bringing together stakeholders to mobilize the community around four priority activities. Can you tell us what those priorities are?
Yeah, and so community engagement is central to the work that we do, right? So we want to make sure that we are creating this sort of awareness. We work directly with communities via listening sessions, via just having conversations. For instance, you know, every November we have, you know, what we call Great American Smokeout, which is really an international movement, and it's about challenging people on one day to not smoke. And we just create this sort of educational awareness piece. We may meet at the Delavan Grotta Community Center with members of the community, and we invite the whole city of Buffalo to be there to support people who are smoking, because our focus is not against people who smoke. Our focus is against tobacco industry and how they're marketing and targeting our communities. So we are about supporting people and helping provide resources for people. But the focus is, again, just about creating that awareness so that people know that there are resources to help them quit. And so community engagement is central to the work that we're doing. Also, we talk about community mobilization. We want the community to be upfront, to use their voice, to have power, to have influence. We talk about government policymaker education. Our focus in my role, my capacity as community engagement program manager, is not to advocate for a particular law, but just simply to educate elected officials about what is happening in a community. Mm-hmm. And so government policymaker education is central to the work that we're doing, as well as advocacy with organizational decision makers, employers. How are we connecting with HR representatives? Do they have smoke-free policies? And how can we assist them with adopting and implementing these policies? So those are different approaches that we have to actually helping to support New York State smoke-free norms.
I hope the messaging on smoke out is clear, yeah, because might attract the wrong folks.
No. You know, it's interesting. We've gotten some stuff, some smoke for that. You know, we've got some smoke about that. But Great American Smoke Out, right? It does sort of play into that right there. But you know, I mean, it's that day where we work with people who do smoke and encourage them, bring them together, encourage them, and let them know that we are supportive of you know, their efforts to quit. And I just on a personal note, you know, I've had many family members who smoke. My wife smokes, and that's always a challenge because smoking is so personal, and because nicotine is so addictive. You know, I mean, you have to be very sensitive and approach it with compassion, understanding that, you know, there's a habit which is deeply ingrained. And one of the things that I, you know, adopt from my professional life is policy. You know, and what I mean is that in my home, you know, we have a policy of no smoking in the home. And so, you know, that helps in a number of ways. I think one of the things it does, it just makes her conscious of the fact that she is smoking, right? And it also, during the wintertime, what we've noticed is that she smokes less, because if she has to go outside to smoke and it's cold outside, yeah, she says, you know, that's one less cigarette I'm going to smoke. Or I'm going to cut this one short. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So policy on that seems to be so trivial, but on a larger level, policy works because it makes people conscious of what they're doing, and it makes them less likely to do it, and even restricts what they can do in certain spaces.
I wanted to talk about these findings from the Tobacco Retail Environment Observations that CAI did.
Great.
It was 2022.
Well, actually, that should be 2022-2023.
Okay, yes.
So sort of kind of major. So that's our year four. You're referring to our year four local data collection report,
mm-hmm,
which essentially was an observation of, I believe, 88 stores in three districts throughout the city of Buffalo.
Largely on the east side.
East
of the city.
Side, correct. Yes. I believe it was Lovejoy. It may have been Ellicott.
And maybe Maston, I believe.
Yeah, Maston District. And we've since done the remaining six districts as well, which is a report that's currently being worked on for our year five local data collection report. I'll make sure that you have that once it's completed. But that is our year four local data collection report of the three districts. And essentially what we did was, when we talk about community mobilization,
mm-hmm,
six community members, who we refer to as community champions, were trained, and on how to do observations using the forms, and were tasked with going through those three districts and looking at the prevalence of tobacco retail marketing, product sales, and among other things, and what the findings are in that report that you have in front of you. And some of the key findings that we talk about, you know, which is really borderline enforcement, we looked at how there were children in stores selling tobacco, right? Children in stores. Now, in New York State, there's, thankfully, we have a 21 and over law for purchasing,
right,
tobacco.
Yes.
But in certain stores in throughout the districts that are meant have been mentioned, there were children selling tobacco, right? There were flavored tobacco products, which technically are illegal, mm-hmm, products, right? And not coincidentally, all of them, I believe, with the exception of one store, sold some form of mentholated tobacco product, right? And, you know, we've already, I think it's well known that, you know, in inner city communities, there is a greater prevalence of mentholated tobacco products, a greater sale and presence of them. 85% right, of black smokers use mentholated tobacco products. 85%. Think about that. Compared to 30% of white smokers. And that disparity is not coincidental. This is a part of a historic development in of marketing and targeting of African American communities back in the 50s, right? You know, and I did my research, you know, less than 5% of black smokers use mentholated tobacco products. In every decade since, there's been this exponential increase where today, from 5% in the 50s to 85% in today. And some would even say 89% of black smokers who smoke use mentholated tobacco products. And you say, well, that's a choice. It isn't.
Right. It isn't. It's ingrained.
It's part of the social norm.
Right.
And so we talk about social norms. Tobacco industry has normalized, African-Americanized, as, you know, Philip Gardner would say, Dr. Philip Gardner would say, African-Americanized mentholated tobacco products. They've made it a part of the black culture.
Right.
It's cool, like, to smoke Newports and, you know.
And we were talking earlier that, you know, you could pick up Jet, you could pick up Ebony, mm-hmm, back in the day and see these, you know, menthol ads.
Yeah, no.
Some of your favorite actors, actresses,
yes,
recording artists, you know, with that cigarette in their mouth.
Yeah, that
it's almost like Billy Dee with the St. Ides.
Come on. And that's how real it was. Like, this is how creative tobacco industry was. Man, they were ahead of the curve when it came to hiring execs. They mm-hmm. hire blacks. I mean, before most other industries were doing it.
Right.
You know, they've invested, poured millions of dollars in black schools, historic black universities. Man, they figured out this is a market that we need to exploit. And the way we do it is pour money into it. You know, so when you talk about the advertisement in Jet magazines, like, you know, I'm old enough to remember seeing those advertisements in Ebony, Jet, mm-hmm. and all of these health magazines and culturally relevant magazines for black. That was targeted and intentional. And consequently, you find that disproportionate use of those products. So today, Swisher Sweets, cool jazz festivals.
Yeah.
In a lot of the hip hop videos and music videos, you find your cigarillos, those little right. flavored tobacco products. That is not coincidental. You know, tobacco industry has creatively found a way to ingrain themselves into the cultural landscape of what it the African American communities.
And then one of the other key findings that menthol cigarettes are widely available across the three districts. 100% of the stores observed across Ellicott, Fillmore, and Lovejoy districts, menthol products were mm-hmm. available. I find that astounding.
It is. And when you think about it, too, I think we were talking about it earlier, right? You know, the overall prevalence of it, right? It's inescapable, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So repeated exposure to something will have an influence on how you think and how you behave, right? So it's not coincidental why, you know, so many black people prefer menthol tobacco, because it is the most available product.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the power wall?
Nice. Yeah. Powerball. So that's for people. We're not talking about the lottery here. You know, Powerball. We're talking about what in tobacco, the tobacco control landscape. We talk about this Powerball, right? So you go into a corner store, and you know, and I'm sure all the listeners can have experience connect to this, right? You go into a store, and you know, you go to buy a bag of chips, you buy, you know, whatever, wine cooler, whatever you're going to purchase, right? And when you get to the cash register and you look up and it's at eye level, whether you're a kid or whether you're, you know, an adult, and you see this colorful array of products,
mm-hmm.
and they're all tobacco, vape, some sort of nicotine product.
Yes.
Right? It is as clear as the sky on a, you know, a warm spring day. You can look up and see it, and you saying, wow. For a child looking at this, you're saying, what the hell is it? It's colorful. I like it.
Yeah, right.
As an adult, you've already been, let me get the Newport 100s.
Right, yeah. You're green, almost programmed.
No, let me get the green pack, not the red pack.
Yeah.
It's in. I want you to understand this. The tobacco industry, that power wall is so influential. Tobacco industry pays to have that real estate in every store that you encounter, every store you go in, that is reserved for the tobacco industry products. That is how they've continued to influence smokers and create this next generation of smokers, is by investment in that particular wall.
So what do the numbers from those key findings, what do they say to you?
Well, a number of things. It says that we have a lot of work to do. It says that, you know, in spite of the fact that in New York State, we've had a lot of success with reducing the smoking rate. But the reality is those numbers don't tell us how, you know, certain communities are disproportionately impacted mm-hmm. by tobacco. You know, namely the African American community, namely the LGBTQIA+ community, namely the Latino community, namely, you know, communities that suffer from mental health communities that, you know, are wrestling with real life issues, like, and who are poor, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I think under certain, under the poverty level, I think the use of tobacco, the use of menthol increases, right? So when you hit a certain level in terms of your ability to make money, or even your educational level, there's a correlation between educational level and tobacco use. So those numbers, they tell a story of how tobacco industry is using or exploiting the vulnerabilities of certain populations.
Yes, and it's
that's
also
what the story is.
And it's also how you mentioned, very intersectional.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly intersects with race. It certainly intersects with economics. Now you mentioned it, you know, in terms of the race, I think we've already spoken about, you know, menthol and African American, you know, users. I want to just put this number out here. 45,000 black lives are lost every year in this country as a result of tobacco related disease and illnesses. That is more than homicides. That is more than suicides. That is more than HIV and AIDS. That is more than accidents combined. 45,000 black lives lost every year in this country as a result of tobacco related disease and illnesses in the African American community, right? That doesn't even include vaping, you know, and the untold story with that, you know, in terms of how tobacco industry is marketed, that and how that's becoming more prevalent in African American communities, you know, how that's affecting youth overall, the health and well-being of youth.
And Governor Kathy Hochul has proposed to end the sale of flavored tobacco, mm-hmm. including menthol cigarettes in the state. Pretty big deal?
Yeah, no. Huge. First of all, and I think one of the things we want to certainly acknowledge her courage, because it takes a lot to stand up to the tobacco industry. You know, they spend over $23 million a day on point of sale advertisement. I mean, there's a huge amount of money involved with, you know, this product that when used as intended will kill you. But last year she had proposed, you know, removing menthol from the shelves, and, you know, and it's a continuation of national efforts. But locally, in New York State, sure, we took, you know, she just joined our movement.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And she gave us that statewide support, you know, and so that was a huge issue. What wasn't mentioned too is that there was an increase in the excise tax on tobacco, which also corresponds to a decreased use. So the higher taxes, the we noticed that there's a decrease in use. But to the menthol issue, you know, locally in Buffalo, you know, we saw it as an opportunity to just go head first and really do some strong work. And, you know, some of the pastors have went to the state to speak to elected officials as well. Locally here in Buffalo, they traveled to New York to speak to the governor, to speak to elected officials. So that is a huge issue. Though we weren't necessarily successful last year, we will continue to work to educate our elected officials. We have not given up on this issue. It will be a continued effort. And like all policy related issues, sometimes, you know, it's about building the community will and building mm-hmm. that to continue to fight. And I want to give a shout out to Rashid Wyatt, Councilman Bowman, and some of the other elected officials in Buffalo Common Council who have had the courage to say, hey, we are not going to tolerate this anymore. We're going to be a part of the work that you're doing.
And I know we spent a lot of time talking about implementation for the inner city, mm-hmm. especially Buffalo's east side, but this is tobacco-free Erie and Niagara.
Correct.
So you have outreach in the rural areas. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, that's always, you know, I appreciate just on a personal level being able to do that work in such a diverse community, because it allows for me to see so much more about how diverse, you know, Western New York is. You know, I could be
because you're a kid from the east side.
Yeah, I'm right from the Fruit Belt, right here. You know, right here in the Fruit Belt, and I could be in Springville in one afternoon, and the next day I could be in North Tonawanda. Mm-hmm. Which is where I live, by the way. Now, let me just be completely transparent. You know, working with Community Health Alliance of North Tonawanda, you know, on some policy and community work, right? And it gives me an opportunity to see what the needs are, the unique set of needs are in those communities. What are the social issues? What are the health issues? And to say, hey, I never thought of it that way. How can I add value to the work that you're doing? You know, but at the heart of it too, when you go, there are some parallels. There are a lot of different common issues. You know, flavors and vaping is impacting every community. You go to Springville, they're talking about the prevalence of vaping. You go to North Tonawanda, you're talking about the prevalence of vaping. You go to Niagara Falls, you talk about these vape products and how children are getting caught in school with them, how children are being suspended, and how children are being impacted in terms of their development, their brain development. And the less time you spend in school, the least likely you are to graduate.
Correct.
And learn. And so this is something that is impacting, you know, not just Black kids in Niagara Falls or Buffalo, but in Springville as well, in Wilson as well, in Marilla, in Elma, and these other places that I've had the opportunity to go to. And at the end of the day, there is a human element.
Yes.
There's a human element that I think connects all of us. And whenever I'm in any room, whether I'm the only Black man person in that room, you know, I find a space, I try to connect with the humanity of people there. You know what I mean? And that's where I feel comfortable at, and I find a space to add value to whatever community that I'm in.
Yeah, and then tailoring that education to the communities, as we were talking earlier. Again, vaping is kind of like a very broad issue, but you know, if you're in the city of Niagara Falls or you're in Buffalo, you may be talking about having conversations about menthol cigarettes. But if you're out in the rural areas, you may be talking about, you know, regular like Marlboros or Camels or the nicotine.
Yeah,
pouches,
the Zen
like
pouches.
Exactly.
And the different sort of spitless tobacco pouches, right? So there are certain cultural pieces that, you know, that you find to be true, and you just try to understand what they are, you know, instead of presuming that you know. And I resist going into communities thinking that I have an answer. I go there thinking that I can be a part of helping find a solution. My expertise in understanding policy and understanding health equity and understanding, tobacco, I bring that to the table, but I don't know what the unique set of needs are. I listen and try to understand, and then I weigh in on how, you know, being a part of the creative process of finding a solution, a policy solution, is where I think, you know, we sit at. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of the organization that I work for, Cicatelli Associates.
And that will do it for Producer's Picks. We thank our guests, Seamus Gallivan and Lindsay Lauren Visser. If you missed anything or you want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at wbfo.org. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. Thanks for listening.